Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with an analysis of whether the five Conservatives on the Supreme Court are politicians in robes, which is the concern expressed by the normally moderate, long-time Supreme Court watcher Linda Greenhouse in an op-ed in the New York Times, Law in the Raw, that has caused shockwaves in the legal community. Elizabeth Wydra, chief counsel of the Constitutional Accountability Project, who frequently participates in Supreme Court litigation, joins us to discuss this second chance the Conservatives on the Supreme Court have given themselves to kill Obamacare by taking up a case already thrown out by lower courts that Linda Greenhouse describes as a politically manufactured argument over how to interpret several sections of the Affordable Care Act. Then we'll examine the $4.25 billion settlement by five of the world's biggest banks, UBS, JP Morgan, Chase, Citigroup, HSBC, and the Royal Bank of Scotland, for conspiring to manipulate the foreign currency markets. James Henry, an economist, lawyer, and investigative journalist, and author of Capital Flight, Corruption, Money Laundering, Tax Evasion, Drug Trafficking, Organized Crime, Terror Banking, and the Continuing Global Development Crisis, joins us to discuss yet another settlement where fines are paid but nobody goes to jail, and the system that allowed traders to manipulate the fixed rate across the world's largest currencies. Then finally, two-time Academy Award-nominated documentary director Marshall Curry joins us in the studio with the subject of his new film, Point and Shoot, Matt Van Dyke. A cinematographer who spent years in North Africa and the Middle East, he joined the rebel army in the Libyan Revolution and was captured, then spent 5.5 months in Gaddafi's notorious prisons, later to be freed to return to combat, where he used both a camera and a gun. We will explore the lines between journalism and active involvement in a revolution and talk about Matt's more recent work in Syria. And joining us now is Elizabeth Wydra, Chief Counsel of the Constitutional Accountability Center, a think tank, law firm, and action center dedicated to showing how the text and history of the Constitution supports progressive outcomes. She frequently participates in Supreme Court litigation and has argued several important cases in the federal courts of appeals. Welcome to Background Briefing, Elizabeth Wydra.
It's great to be with you.
And Elizabeth, the article by Linda Greenhouse certainly seems to have shaken up the legal community. She's not given to hyperbole. I've seen her a lot on the PBS NewsHour, where she's always quite measured and quite moderate. But it seems that in many ways that she's just quite genuinely fed up, and she's gone through a kind of crisis here in terms of defending the Supreme Court. She's really reaching the point now where she's not sure that the conservative justices on the Supreme Court are not politicians in robes. She doesn't want to believe that, but at this point, she's pretty much on the edge of believing it. Is that how you would interpret it?
I thought her piece was incredibly interesting, and in part for the reasons you said. You know, throughout her long career as a Supreme Court reporter, she has generally taken a much more measured tone. And I don't know if it's just the freedom she feels now that she's no longer her day-to-day job as the Supreme Court reporter for the New York Times. But, you know, I do feel like there is something to the idea that after you see enough decisions that seem to be based on reaching certain political outcomes rather than a neutral application of the law, then I think that can cause some degree of disillusionment, and that certainly sounded like what was coming through in her column.
Well, she starts out by talking about the Bush v. Gore decision to end the stalemate in Florida in 2000, but she makes the point that without excusing that decision, it at least was, you could arguably, was some kind of national crisis of governance. But in this case, where at least four conservatives on the Supreme Court have decided to take up a case that the lower courts have kicked out, including the D.C. Court of Appeals, which there was a ruling in favor of it, 2-1, but then it was overturned by the full court. So yet they have decided to take up this argument, which Linda Greenhouse says is a politically manufactured argument. But it could have devastating effects on the Affordable Care Act, and that's obviously what is concerning here. Can you describe us how we got to this point?
Yeah, so, you know, I mean, she's certainly right about the idea that this is a politically manufactured argument. You know, and we know that because one of my colleagues at CAC, Joey Meyer, wrote a great article discussing the origins of this lawsuit and how basically conservatives who were opposed to the act wanted to find any way possible to kill the bill. And one of their ways that they thought they could do this was by seizing on this four-word phrase, which talks about subsidies being available on exchanges established by the state, and saying that that meant that if states didn't set up their own exchanges, if instead they used the healthcare.gov website, then that meant that low- and middle-income Americans who need financial assistance in order to afford health insurance could not get those subsidies. That's not what the law says if you read it in its entirety. That's certainly not what the members of Congress who passed it, who I actually represent in the case and have filed a brief going on the record, that's not what they meant when they wrote the law. So it is this completely, basically outcome-focused argument that has been used to try to get rid of the Affordable Care Act. And, you know, what is interesting that Linda focuses on is that normally the court only will weigh in when there is disagreement among the federal courts of appeals. And here, as you mentioned, Ian, there was a Fourth Circuit ruling, which is out of Virginia, that threw out these challenges. And then in the D.C. Circuit, there was initially a ruling that was in favor of the law's challengers, but then it was vacated by the full D.C. Circuit, and those proceedings were actually ongoing. They hadn't actually issued a ruling yet. And so that's what's sort of unusual is that the what's called the en banc D.C. Circuit hadn't even finished its proceedings before the court decided to grant review. And that's fairly unusual, and I think that's what some people took to be a very political act by, you know, you need four justices to grant review for the Supreme Court, and we don't know who those justices are, the ones that voted, because that's not disclosed, but I do think it's a pretty good guess that it was the four conservative justices who dissented from the ruling upholding the Affordable Care Act in the first place when it got to the court in 2012.
And again, I'm speaking with Elizabeth Wydra, Chief Counsel of the Constitutional Accountability Center, a think tank law firm and action center dedicated to showing how the text and history of the Constitution supports progressive outcomes. She frequently participates in Supreme Court litigation and has argued several important cases in the federal courts of appeals. But what Linda Greenhouse is suggesting here in her New York Times article, Law in the Raw, that has, as I say, it's created quite a flurry within the legal community. She's suggesting that there's a possible scenario, which she says is a theory, that the four that you just mentioned, minus John Roberts, are still, the four conservatives, are still upset over what the right wing in this country regards as the Chief Justice's betrayal 2 years ago when he upheld Obamacare, the Affordable Care Act. And she said that she didn't take it too seriously until she read a piece by John Yoo, who, of course, is famous for authorizing torture during the Bush-Cheney years. He's now at Berkeley. And he basically says that this is a chance for the Chief Justice, quoting, a chance to atone for his error in upholding Obamacare, and that it will be the mission of this Chief Justiceship to repair the damage. So there's obviously conservatives out there who really feel that John Roberts betrayed them, and that somehow the job of the Supreme Court is to kill off this major piece of legislation, which is the centerpiece of the Obama administration.
Yeah, it's really remarkable that conservatives have not been shy about being extremely critical of the Chief Justice for his vote upholding the Affordable Care Act. And it's interesting that the lead lawyer in this current challenge to the Affordable Care Act, that's before the Supreme Court this year, he was also involved in that initial challenge that went up to the court. And he was quoted on the record saying just a month or so ago that he didn't think that he would lose any of the conservative votes on the court. But, you know, this is in contrast to the Chief Justice's own words saying that he doesn't want the American public to think of the justices as Democrats or Republicans. He hopes that the court does not be, is not seen as partisan in the same way that the other branches of government are. And, you know, certainly I think a lot of people, and I guess maybe now Linda Greenhouse, would disagree with the Chief Justice that that's how the court currently operates. But certainly that's the way that the Chief Justice wants the court to be viewed. And so, you know, I think it might backfire on some of these conservatives to, you know, be so blatantly appealing to his ideological leanings and saying, you know, you should be a good Republican and vote the party line, because he has said very publicly that that's not how he wants the court to be viewed. And so if he wants the court to be viewed as being nonpartisan, you know, in this case that's currently before the court, if you apply standard rules of the way that courts are supposed to interpret statutes, then it's clear that the text of the law makes financial assistance available to Americans who need it, regardless of the state they live in. And so the arguments that the conservatives are using against the law really cannot be taken up by any fair-minded judge. So if the judges are truly being, as Chief Justice Roberts said, nonpartisan and not voting as Republicans or Democrats, but voting according to the law, then they should reject this latest challenge to the law. And I think that comments like John Hughes could backfire.
Well, absolutely. And I thank you for joining us, Elizabeth Widerer. This would be the ultimate in judicial activism if they were to strike down the Affordable Care Act based on a couple of typos. I thank you for joining us, Elizabeth Widerer, again, Chief Counsel of the Constitutional Accountability Center, and she frequently participates in Supreme Court litigation and has argued several important cases in the Federal Courts of Appeals. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back talking about the $4.25 billion settlement by the five biggest banks in the world, who were conspiring to manipulate foreign currency markets. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is James Henry, an economist, lawyer, and investigative journalist, and former chief economist at McKinsey & Company. He is an Edward R. Murrow Fellow at Tufts University's Fletcher School of Law and Diplomacy and Inspire Fellow at the Institute for Global Leadership. His books include Pirate Bankers, First-Hand Investigations of Private Banking, Capital Flight, Corruption, Money Laundering, Tax Evasion, Drug Trafficking and Organized Crime, Terror Banking, and the Continuing Global Development Crisis, and The Blood Bankers, Tales from the Global Underground Economy. Welcome to Background Briefing, James Henry.
Good to be with you.
And regulators in the United States, Britain, and Switzerland just fined some of the world's biggest banks a combined $4.25 billion. That's UBS, JP Morgan Chase, Citigroup, HSBC, and the Royal Bank of Scotland. So the fine seems to be heavy, unless sometimes these fines are less than meets the eye. But again, nobody's going to jail.
Yeah, exactly. Well, this is an incredible story, but it's a continuation of the behavior that we've seen over the last 5 years. And, you know, this year, banks, these big banks have been fined just by the U.S. authorities alone more than $57 billion. In this case, they were involved. I think you left one out. Bank of America was also fined today. You know, this is just for rigging the world's largest market, liquid market, which is the currency market. It's about $5.3 trillion per day of currency trading. And here you have the biggest banks in the world, you know, trying to make more money than they already do by rigging this this market. This is behavior went on over the last, at least the last 5 years. and the regulators finally caught up with it.
Well, Barclays, of course, was another bank involved. They withdrew from the settlement at the last minute over concerns that it would only resolve a fraction of their liabilities. So would that suggest that there's more shoes to drop?
Oh, yeah. There's at least 15 or 20 investigations of this kind of rigging going on. There's also the LIBOR rigging. LIBOR is the interest rate that's used to price many international loans, and many of these same banks were also involved in that. In fact, if you look at the incidence of corporate crime among the top 20 or so global banks over the last, just the last 5 years, you'll see, you know, these same cast of characters involved in tax dodging, LIBOR rigging, money laundering, fraudulent mortgage securities, sanctions busting, the currency market rigging that we saw today, muni fraud, rigging the metals and energy markets, corporate bribery, and credit card fraud. So, you know, I've run out of columns. I tried to track all of this, but, you know, plainly there's a problem with the culture of these institutions. I mean, you know, it reminds me of Brecht's famous statement where he said, what is the crime of burgling a bank compared to the crime of owning one? You know, the problem has really been that no executives, I think, one problem basically, no executives have gone to jail. You know, you have the same recurrent problem of every time these problems occur, the bank board of directors or the CEOs say, oh, we didn't know about this, we'll clean it up. You know, we're talking about the entire trading floors of major financial institutions being involved in rigging currency and interest rates and money money markets that are of fundamental importance to the world economy. So at some point, you know, it's not enough for traders to lose their jobs or their bonuses. Someone actually has to do jail time.
Well, from what you've described, I guess it sounds like these people do banking in their spare time.
Well, that's right. I think the problem with the banking industry is it's fundamentally kind of a commodity business. I mean, the you know, these currency trading should be going on at a very low, you know, fractions of pennies per dollar in terms of profits to the institutions making these markets. The only way you get up to the kind of 20% plus returns on equity that bank investors got used to prior to the financial crisis is to, you know, play these kinds of games. And the biggest problem they created was with all the fraudulent mortgage-backed securities that they issued. You know, we're still paying the price for the financial crisis. All of these players also, by the way, got deeply involved in, you know, getting money from bailouts from Federal Reserve and from European Central Bank. And, you know, so they received literally hundreds of billions of dollars in not only direct investments, but also subsidized loans over the last 5 years to get the economy back in order. So in this corner of reality, here they are violating the law with impunity. And at the same time, we have bailed them out. So I think basically what you've got is, you know, a situation where these are also institutions that have a lot of political power. You know, they're able to pass along these fines and penalties off to their customers or their shareholders. You know, there's just not any substitute for having a more competitive banking industry. I think making institutions smaller. These banks are in many cases, I think, too big to jail. And for also having much stiffer penalties for the people involved in these crimes.
Again, I'm speaking with James Henry, who's an economist, lawyer, and investigative journalist, and the former chief economist at McKinsey & Company. He is an Edward R. Murrow Fellow at Tufts University's Fletcher School of Law and Diplomacy and Inspire Fellow at its Institute for Global Leadership. His books include Pirate Bankers, First-Hand Investigations of Private Banking, Capital Flight, Corruption, Money Laundering, Tax Evasion, Drug Trafficking, Organized Crime, Terror Banking, and the Continuing Global Development Crisis, and The Blood Bankers, Tales from the Global Underground Economy. economy. But just to get some context onto what these traders call themselves, these sort of, you know, buccaneer type of names, we've also heard that before in this kind of testosterone-driven world. You know, they call themselves the players, the three musketeers, etc. But I guess you mentioned the enormous volume that's traded in the currency markets. These are the biggest markets in the world, aren't they? And they pretty much operate 24/7.
Yeah, it's the biggest financial markets in the world. They're fundamental to all, trade, international trade. There's lots of clients in the market who are working, through these banks to buy and sell currency. And in this case, they were basically making money off their own clients. In many cases, front-running. They'd get a signal from what the clients were buying, and they'd go ahead and purchase beforehand and then sell to the clients, basically stealing money from their own clients. I've read through the indictments that were produced in this, and the plea documents, and there's a lot of good gory details about the exact technicalities of all this, how it worked out from a number of big institutions like Citibank and J.P. Morgan and Bank of America are just up to their eyeballs in this. And it's quite disturbing to read about, the traders going into private chat rooms and talking to their direct competitors about how to manipulate the market, knowing full well what their customers were buying so that they would be able to secure above normal profits on these trades. I mean, it's just completely unprincipled. It shows a kind of rotten culture. At some level, given the pattern of criminality, you have to say, these big institutions are basically kind of criminal enterprises. They've allowed themselves to develop cultures where the only thing that counts is profit for their own individuals, their own internal traders and senior executives who are looking at these. I mean, it should have occurred to the senior executives in these organizations that their trading operations were, a little bit too profitable. I mean, look, they shouldn't just take it on faith that, those profits are just earned, but they should ask questions about how they're able to sustain higher profits than, most trading operations are used to. I think there's, it took the regulators in this case about 18 months to be able to investigate all this. And even during the kind of misconduct even continued during the whole period when, they were being investigated. So, it's hard for regulators to simply kind of catch up with past misbehavior. What we need are much stronger penalties and deterrence that actually put some people behind bars for these serious white-collar crimes.
So would the banks, their failure to have, controls and oversight over these systems that allowed traders to manipulate the fixed rate across the world's largest currencies, is the explanation then that there's a tacit agreement between the traders who are making money for themselves and for the bank, and for the bank who are making, as you say, profits that sometimes look like they're too good to be true?
Yeah, I mean, basically this couldn't go on without collusion across company lines among all the people involved in trading, say, the U.S. dollar against the British pound. As one trader said, he was, in a chat room, he said, how can I make free money with no effing heads up? And he was saying, give me a heads up on what your position is so that I can know what my position should be. And so it gets very technical to understand what they were doing, but at the end of the day, it's pretty simple. If you have information on where your clients or orders are going, and you're allowed to share that with your competitors, it's hard not to make money on the deal.
So if you have these big buy or sell orders, what they do is what you said, they do front running, which, by the way, is legal on Wall Street because of these massive high-speed computerized systems that they have, that all the big banks have installed right next to the exchanges, so that they get these microsecond advantages to trade ahead of their clients. And that seems to be a vast form of legalized front running.
Well, that's another variation on this. That doesn't involve direct collusion so much as it just has, you know, you get a first look at what your customer's order inventory is. But here we have actual collusion with resetting to what they call the mark-to-market rates at the end of the day. And there's a whole complicated dance that goes on around the closing of the market with respect to those rates and clearing customer orders. Bottom line is that the banks involved in this knew or should have known. The senior bank manager should have been aware, you know, of what was going on here. But I think to generalize this, to take it to a higher level, look at all the different kinds of corporate crimes you have. You know, this week, coming up next week, we have a hearing before a federal judge reviewing Credit Suisse's plea bargain with respect to a massive tax evasion case involving sending private bankers to the United States, helping wealthy clients take their money to Switzerland, not paying taxes on it. You know, in this case, again, you know, they're getting off with a tax deductible fine of $2 billion. No executives going to jail. They're not even having to reveal client names. And so, you know, once again, because the banks are very powerful politically, and because you know, the Justice Department has been concerned about really, you know, causing them, you know, because of their importance in the economy, causing them serious problems. You know, we have a case of where they keep on doing it again. So, over time, I think the dilemma has been the banks have been able to play the card that says, you know, we're too important to the economy. I think we actually have to, you know, to call their bluff on that and say, you know, over time, the cost that you're imposing on the economy through all of this funny business is really dwarfing the kind of short-run effects of taking one of the banks down. And, you know, bank like Credit Suisse, which is a serial violator of U.S. laws, of laws in other countries, is a good candidate for saying, you know, well, we're going to cut off your access to the U.S. Financial market for a while and see how that plays out.
Well, the logic that you're describing of these banks being too big to prosecute and you don't want to really go after them because it'll upset the global economy, that was the kind of logic expressed some time back by the Attorney General, Eric Holder, and his deputy in charge of going after those who caused the 2008 crash. At least that's...
Well, that's right. I mean, Eric Holder is going to go back to Covington and Burling, where he was actually working for banks like UBS and Credit Suisse. And, you know, there are lots of conflicts of interest here. I mean, the problem that we have is a government that has a kind of revolving door relationship with these big financial institutions. So, you know, the current Secretary of the Treasury used to work at Citibank. I mean, is he going to be a, you know, stand up and demand, you know, a real cleanup of... these financial institutions? No, I mean, the current head of the IRS, chief legal counsel for the IRS, used to be a registered representative for the Swiss Bankers Association. I mean, you have lots of conflicts of interest here at a senior level. So it's nice to have these big numbers, that, you know, big fines that look big on paper, but actually as a share of bank profits, you know, they're really a slap on the wrist. And they haven't, the bottom line is they really haven't had a serious impact on bank behavior, you know, across this whole spectrum of criminal white-collar crime. We've seen the kind of market rigging, the money laundering, the fraudulent mortgage securities, in this case, the currency rigging, just continue on and on. So I think we have to take a hard look at the failure of the enforcement strategy that we've adopted toward these big institutions and see, you know, what do we need to do to get them to behave?
Well, just in closing, how would you somehow instill some morality, some economic patriotism in this culture that you describe? And these are manifestations of a culture of impunity, of total disregard for the average American, for the law, for that matter. I mean, you know, there was, of course, those earlier books by Tom Wolfe about Masters of the Universe, and it doesn't look as if that's changed.
I don't think the cultural approach works. I think what they understand is tough penalties. Bigger fines, of course, that hits the shareholders more than it does the bank managers. But I think some of the bank managers ought to be called to account for their behavior. Senior bankers should not be allowed to continue in executive positions if they're in these institutions. And you know, this happens on their watch over and over again. And I think fundamentally there's also, we have to face up to, I think, a structural problem. You know, the top four or five banks in the United States have seen a substantial increase in their market share across multiple financial markets since 1990. And with that increase in market share, there goes, I think, a kind of impunity and another, and also a new level of political influence. So I think we need to look more carefully at structural changes. In other words, breaking up banks, maybe reinstalling the Glass-Steagall prohibitions. You know, just having more competitive institutions, I think, would reduce the amount of political clout any one of them would have, and their leverage on the regulators. The regulators are not just an uncaused cause. They are, you know, responding to the political pressures around them. And so it's great to see this global cooperation on enforcement. This is the kind of cross-border collaboration we really need to have, because the global banks really, you know, do operate across borders. And this is a great case of that, involving, you know, a very international market they were collectively rigging. But it's tough to get regulators across borders to get into alignment on issues like this. It was, shows you how you know, so how bad the offenses really had to be in order for them to align just to prosecute these six banks. There's now about 20 investigations going on. This is not going to be the last chapter in this, so this topic is going to be around for a while. But you know, I think ordinary Americans have to wake up and realize that their financial institutions are, in many ways, out of control. And they have to demand that the regulation get tougher, you know, in advance, you know, that we have tougher sanctions after the fact. But the real cure for this would be to have some fundamental structural reform in the banking system. And that would require, I think, you know, looking at the existing market concentration.
Well, James Henry, I thank you so much for joining us here today.
Oh, you're quite welcome.
Again, I've been speaking with James Henry. He's an economist, lawyer, and investigative journalist, and former chief economist at McKinsey & Company. He is an Edward R. Murrow Fellow at Tufts University's Fletcher School of Law and Diplomacy and Inspire Fellow at its Institute for Global Leadership. His books include Pirate Bankers, First-Hand Investigations of Private Banking, Capital Flight, Corruption, Money Laundering, Tax Evasion, Drug Trafficking, Organized Crime, Terror Banking, and the Continuing Global Development Crisis, and The Blood Bankers, Tales from the Global Underground Economy. We're going to take a brief station break. We'll be back joined by the filmmaker and the subject of the extraordinary new documentary, Point and Shoot.
The peddlers and the meddlers, they buy and they sell. They destroyed your city, they'll destroy you as well. The lecherous and treacherous, a hair meant for leather, each of them bigger than our men put together. Sluggers and muggers wearing fancy gold.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now in the studio is Marshall Curry and Matt Van Dyke. Marshall Curry is a two-time Academy Award-nominated documentary director whose films include Street Fight, Racing Dreams, Mistaken for Strangers, and If a Tree Falls, A Story of the Earth Liberation Front. His latest film just out is Point and Shoot. And Matt Van Dyke, the subject of Marshall Curry's new film, is a cinematographer who has spent years in North Africa and the Middle East traveling and filming various projects. He joined the rebel army during the Libyan Revolution, documenting his experiences in the war while fighting in it. During the war, he was captured and held as a prisoner of war for nearly 6 months in two of Libya's most notorious prisons, before escaping from prison and returning to combat on the front lines. After the war in Libya, he went to Syria, where he shot and directed the award-winning short film, Not Anymore, A Story of Revolution. Welcome to Background Briefing, Marshall Curry.
Thank you very much.
And Matt is stuck in L.A. traffic.
He'll be here any minute.
So he'll be here at any minute. So tell me then, Marshall, before your subject arrives, how did you come across this fellow? Because the film is fascinating. It explores you know, American myth, American manhood. This is an average kid. He's the son of a – he's a single child of a single child of a single child.
Right,
you know, it's a lineage there of being, you know, closeted, pampered. And he grows up on a diet of video games and action fantasies and wants to be a spy and all these things. And he goes off to the Middle East with a motorcycle and does the most extraordinary things. And you see this evolution of this sort of gawky kid from, you know, middle class spoiled comfort, suddenly ending up being a warrior in a real revolutionary. I mean, there's a wonderful moment there where he's sitting around where the Libyan rebels are planning a battle and the commander is there and somebody says, Are you a journalist? Are you press? Or are you a revolutionary? And he said, I'm a revolutionary.
Right.
So how'd you meet this guy?
Well, it was kind of extraordinary. I just got an email one day from him. He had seen, I guess, some of my films and sent me an email saying that he had returned from Libya recently, where he'd been fighting with the revolutionaries to overthrow Gaddafi. And he'd had a camera with him while he was there. And he also had a camera with him for the years before when he'd gone on this extraordinary 35,000-mile motorcycle trip through northern Africa and the Middle East. And he thought it would make an interesting documentary. And so I said, wow, why don't you come up to New York and let me hear your story.
And that literally from – he took a motorcycle from Morocco across North Africa through Egypt, through the Middle East, through Iraq, all the way to Afghanistan.
That's right.
Extraordinary journey.
Right. Yeah.
So, and he's actually just showed up. So, we'll be talking with him in a second. So, clearly, you were given both a gift of a subject.
Right.
But he came with film.
And footage.
How often
and
does
footage.
That happen?
Not very often. It was, right. it was a treat.
Matt, just grab that chair there, if you don't mind. So, we're talking without you. We're talking about you, Matt. And Matt Van Dyke, again, you're the subject of Marshall Curry's new film. You're a cinematographer. You spent years in North Africa and the Middle East traveling and filming various projects. You joined the rebel army during the Libyan Revolution, documenting your experiences while fighting in it. And during the war, you were captured and held as a prisoner of war for nearly 6 months in two of Libya's most notorious prisons before escaping from prison and returning to combat on the front lines. After the war in Libya, you've been to Syria, where you shot and directed the award-winning short film, Not Anymore, A Story of Revolution. So thanks for joining us. And I must say, the thing that I found most touching about your film was how, you know, just as this sort of adventurer, you bribed your way into Libya, Gaddafi's Libya, and you ran into a bunch of guys who liked motorcycles, since you've been traveling around the Middle East on a motorcycle. And these sort of became, you know, it seemed like they became your first buddies, for, you know, at least real buddies.
Well, not the first ever, but the first buddies during the travels.
Right.
First people I really got close to.
Right.
During all those years of traveling.
But you stayed with them, and they ended up being the core of this rebel group that you fought with.
Some of them. I met them in 2008. And I met the one that I was in the war with in 2007. So I'd known them a few years before I went back to fight. I wasn't with the bikers during the war, but I was with my friend Nori, a Libyan hippie turned fighter, who I'd known for 4 years before the war started.
And he was a real peace love and puka shells guy, right?
Yeah, he was. He was, which is quite different from myself. But right. when the time for war came, he changed pretty quick.
That was extraordinary, you know, and I kept thinking, because the good guys always die young, and I kept thinking, my God, something's going to happen to this guy. But he survived.
Yeah.
The last time you see him in the movies, he's by the seashore, and there's what floats by in the water is a carpet with Gaddafi's picture, you know, portrait on it.
And Nouri went back pretty much to being a hippie. After the war, he's back traveling, and the war didn't change him much. You know, when it was time for the war, he did what he needed to do, and now he's back to his normal life.
But the country's a complete mess, right? Is he in Libya?
No, he's traveling mostly right. in Africa.
Right. So, Marshall, do you think that some of the criticism is that of the film, at least one of the reviews I read was that somehow you have, you know, not told us what's happening to Libya today,
right.
so to take the edge off the idea that this was some heroic adventure, when in fact it's still a mess. I mean, I don't know that people have to keep making, you know. Additions to their films.
Right.
If you get trapped in that, there's an unending.
You just make one film for the rest of your life.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Right.
So yeah, there was a review that said, how come they don't have a card at the end that explains what happened in Libya? And I sort of feel like, and then 6 months later we'd have another card, and 6 months later we'd have another card. So
right.
I mean, fundamentally, this wasn't it's not a film about the Libyan Revolution. I mean, it takes
right.
place during the Libyan Revolution, and it has some great insights into that revolution and some footage that's extraordinary. But it's really a coming-of-age story about a person, and you know, that was the thing that attracted me to it in the first
right.
place.
Well, you say that the Matt's experience was a crash course in manhood, right?
Yeah, he actually said that.
Oh,
so,
you said
yeah,
that.
Yeah. I mean, yeah. And when he first mentioned that phrase to me, it just kind of jumped out, and
right.
I just thought it was extraordinary to think of yourself as going on a crash course in manhood. It's just such a terrific turn of words.
But Matt, given your mother and your girlfriend and all the anguish that they go through, particularly when you disappeared for almost 6 months, the question that would come up for an American watching this movie would be, you know, what motivated you to fight in somebody else's war? What, you know, normally a lot of kids signed up after 9/11, for example, you know. That you can understand the cause and effect there, or the motivation. But what was your motivation to join this war?
Well, I had good friends in Libya, so it was very personal to me. You know, when your friends need help, whether they need help moving a sofa in their apartment or they need help getting rid of a dictator, you should help your friends either way. So that was one reason. Also, I'd seen the effects of authoritarianism throughout the region and how it affects every level of society. And this was an opportunity to contribute to change in a region that I had a lot of experience in over the years.
And why in that horrible prison? Because why, I think, I don't know whether it's the prison in which Gaddafi's people just slaughtered everybody, you know, several years before the revolution, but they kept you alive because you're an American? Was that what it was?
Oh, I mean, who knows?
Uh-huh.
I mean, there were a few Libyan Americans held, I found out later, in other parts of the prison. There was a U.S. Contractor who used to be a Navy SEAL who was held in another prison that the Gaddafi regime didn't tell anybody about. So, you know, their patterns of behavior during the war were quite strange.
Mm-hmm.
Why they didn't use myself or that former Navy SEAL for propaganda, we'll never know. I guess just stupidity on their part.
Well, maybe they had their hands full, too.
Perhaps. I do think they put us in there and they sort of forgot us. I mean, Abdullah Sanusi is Gaddafi's head of intel. Left Tripoli so late, he left files all over his desk, and he barely even got out in time.
So tell us about, we were just talking earlier with Marshall about how this is, for a filmmaker, this is an unusual gift. Not only do you get an interesting subject, the subject comes with years and years of film because you filmed that extraordinary odyssey that you took across North Africa and the Middle East, and then you filmed everything that happened to you and to the guys that you're fighting with throughout the Libyan revolution, except, of course, for the almost 6 months you were in Gaddafi's jail. What's the sense then of how, in the first part of the film, when you're in Iraq, you are a sort of a journalist, and you know there are certain rules to journalism. You know that you're not the story, and you know you just you have some immunity because you're taking pictures. Later on, you crossed the line. In fact, you didn't cross the line. You did both. You had both a gun and a camera. So, did those things ever come across your kind of professional radar at all?
No, I mean, all my work had been autobiographical. I dabbled in journalism in 2009, tried it out as an embed reporter in Iraq. You know, I got a front page story, and the next day the newspaper went out of business, and I never got paid. So actually, well,
you could get a job here.
Yeah. So that was about it for me in journalism. So, right. You know, that was really just, I tried it out. I had not done journalism for a couple years before I even went to fight in Libya. So, you know, for me to film my own experiences in a war and to take notes for an autobiographical book that I already had a draft of before I went to Libya about the motorcycle years, I mean, it was all autobiographical work, just like I'd set out to do all those years before. I like to say that people refer to me as a former journalist, but one summer I had a job as a roofer, and I actually have laid far more roof tiles than I've ever written articles. So they should call me a former roofer, if anything.
Okay. And Marshall Curry, again, two-time Academy Award-winning nominated documentary director. And we're talking about his latest film, Just Out, Point and Shoot, along with the subject of the film, Matt Van Dyke.
We should probably mention that it's playing at the New Art this weekend, so we hope people can come out and take a look. Matt,
well, what about the rest of the country? Because this goes out to other stations.
Yeah, so it's playing in New York right now. It opens in L.A. at the New Art, and then over the course of November and December, it'll roll out to about 50 other cities. People can go to the website pointandshootfilm.com. And click on see it, and it lays out all those different cities and where it plays and when.
So, one of the amazing things about the film is, and I guess we know that this happened from the coverage we saw, but that place seemed to be awash with weapons, and Gaddafi, you know, was obsessed about buying weapons. I mean, there's lots of scenes of you guys just opening up crates of weapons. It's almost like, you know, walking through a candy store and picking out different candy, you know.
Well, we had no shortage of weapons and ammunition. That's for sure. You know, Gaddafi restricted weapons quite a lot during his rule because he knew that one day if people got them, they'd overthrow him. So it was really because military units in the East especially defected early on in the revolution. So not only did we have guns and ammunition, we also had tanks. And Grad rockets and other things that were incredibly helpful in the conflict. There are a lot of people in Syria right now fighting against the Assad regime wish that they had.
Right. Well, of course, there's a relationship between those two. The fall of Gaddafi inspired the Syrians to rise up. At least there's certainly a coincidence there, surely.
Yes, and I believed, and a lot of us believed at the time, that it was the next domino to fall, and after that we'd see a new wave of revolutions. But unfortunately, that hasn't happened now because of Syria.
Right. So what's your analysis of why that the Syrians are being hung out to dry? Even our Secretary of State at the time, Hillary Clinton, said that Assad's about to fall. It hasn't happened. Now you have the paradox where we're bombing the people who are fighting Gaddafi. I mean, fighting, I keep confusing these two. Not that that's entirely inappropriate. Assad. So it frees up Assad to turn his guns on the Free Syrian Army, the people that we're supposed to be supporting.
Right. I mean, a lot of these problems exist because the administration didn't take action early enough. ISIS wouldn't even exist if a Libya-style air campaign had been done in support of Syrian revolutionaries back in 2011 or even 12. This war would be in its final stages. But instead, we did nothing. Jihadists flooded into Syria, and now we have ISIS and a lot of other problems.
So is there a sense then that since you are this, you're described often as a naive American, you just took a motorcycle trip around throughout this entire region. One of the things I keep hearing from specialists on the Middle East is how simply we don't understand this region. I mean, That's the refrain I keep getting. Did you feel that you got a handle on what was happening?
I mean, I don't know where you got Naive American from. Maybe one of these reviews.
Yes, some of the reviews. Yes.
Some of those reviews are they have created fiction about myself and the film. I mean, I have a master's degree in Middle East Security Studies from Georgetown.
Right.
I spent years in the region. I did know Arabic before I went to the region. You know, I do media appearances routinely on Fox News, MSNBC, and other networks as an international security analyst. So,
well, you came to the right place then. So tell me, are we again afflicted? I mean, there's nothing more graphic in terms of the folly of blundering into a war, which was what happened in Iraq, without thinking through the consequences. We don't know the people. We don't know who we're fighting for and against. That certainly seems to be the tableau in Syria. And most people would say that what's happening in Libya now is also an example of how, you know, there's so much factionalism. What you're telling us is that this was not preordained that these places would be a mess. It's just that we didn't step up. Is that your main argument?
Well, there was disengagement from Libya after the fighting was done. That didn't help. But it's quite common for a country to go through a civil war following a revolution or civil war. So historically, this isn't unheard of, what's happening in Libya. And in the case of Syria, it really was not that complicated early on. There was a never united, but a relatively secular and moderate Islamist opposition to Assad that could have been supported before other elements arose, before al-Qaeda was active in Syria, before ISIS was active in Syria. Mm-hmm. These are developments that happen when you let a conflict like this continue unabated and you have foreign jihadis flock in. It happens every time.
Right. And you also had in the early days tremendous defections from Assad's military, who presumably could have been the core of some kind of rebel army.
Right. And a lot of them were, but they weren't supported. When I was in Syria, they didn't even have ammunition. I mean, they were paying out of their own pocket $1 a bullet for an AK-47. So you can't fight a war like that. They weren't supported. They got slaughtered. And the ones that didn't quit, the best men in the revolution are already dead. And I really don't know where it's going to go from here, but it does not look good. I don't see Assad going anywhere anytime soon.
And Marshal Curry, what's your sense then you didn't do a political film,
right,
obviously.
Right.
You did a portrait of Matt.
Right.
But, forgive me for tapping into the fact that he's a specialist,
because
that's who I talk to all day long, the deputy director of the Center for the Study of Middle East and the North Africa and all this kind of stuff, you know.
Right.
So what's your sense then of what you're trying to communicate via your film?
Well, I mean, I guess what was so interesting to me about Matt's story was the coming of age aspect of it. So the idea that somebody who grew up, you know, quite sheltered, living in, you know, his mother's basement, he explains that when he was in college, his mother and his grandmother would come and, you know, stock his refrigerator and do his laundry for him. And the idea of setting off on a crash course in manhood and going out and having these adventures and then to have your view of manhood shift over time. I think when he first started, it was largely kind of action, motorcycle riding and things like that, getting into trouble and finding adventure. And when the Arab Spring happened, his view of manhood was stretched, I think, a little bit by the bravery that he saw of revolutionaries that were risking their lives not just for action and adventure, but for a really important cause. And and then, you know, to go into that war and grow and change the way that he did is that was the element that really drew me. Of course, when it's set against an Arab civil war, it's even more dramatic than most people's coming of age stories.
For sure. And Matt, since you did spend time in Iraq and Afghanistan, what's your sense then of our responsibility as a nation to? I mean, you were saying earlier that we sort of walked away from Libya, washed our hands of it, and it's a mess. And it looks like we can't wait to get out of Afghanistan.
Right. I mean, we see in Iraq the consequences of disengaging now when the Iraqi army can't stand up against ISIS. But at the same time, I mean, we can't stay there forever. And Afghanistan, once we pull out of Afghanistan, I believe Afghanistan will go the way of Iraq. The Taliban will have a resurgence, and a lot of what people fought and died for and what this country invested a lot of blood and treasure in will unfortunately be lost. But I hope that we learn a lesson about letting locals do more of the heavy lifting in these conflicts and supporting them the way that it was done in Libya instead of the way that it was done in Iraq.
Right. But in terms of holding people accountable, I mean, is there, when we talk about lives and treasure, trillions of dollars. This is not, I mean, maybe we don't, aren't required to win wars anymore. We certainly haven't won a war since 1945.
Well, we have short memories. So, you know, after we sort of get it handed to us in one of these conflicts, we go about 15 years where we become a little more isolationist and sometimes too far, I believe, as we've done in the case of Syria. But eventually we will be back, probably making some of the same mistakes again. That's just the way history goes.
Right.
But, you know, history will have to hold those who dragged us into Iraq and Afghanistan accountable for their actions. But, you know, people in the end will go about more caring about what Kim Kardashian's doing than worrying about history.
Well, that's depressing, but nevertheless realistic thought. Ted, so, by the way, what in Afghanistan, what was the Afghan cop beating you up over? And didn't get a clear picture of that.
I was stopping to buy firewood. I was there with an American photographer riding motorcycles and making a film, and they thought we were Al-Qaeda. We were in the Panjshir Valley,
right.
And we looked like Al-Qaeda because we were trying to blend in, but the cop was very angry and punched me in the face and arrested us.
I see.
On camera. It's great. It's a
yes.
great scene.
Yeah, again, the gift of not only a subject, right. but a subject who comes with film. Well, I can't recommend the film more because I thought it was really an interesting film. And I'm glad that I met you, actually. And we should follow up, you know, because I talk about the Middle East all the time. And
sure.
you certainly had some real experience. So I appreciate you both of you joining me. Marshall Curry, two-time Academy Award-nominated documentary director, whose films include Street Fight, Racing Dreams, Mistaken for Strangers, and If a Tree Falls, a Story of the Earth Liberation Front.
I should probably jump in and say Mistaken for Strangers I just executive produced. Somebody else directed that one.
But your latest film just out is Point and Shoot. And Matt Van Dyke is the subject of Marshall Curry's new film, a cinematographer who spent years in North Africa and Middle East traveling and filming various projects. He joined the rebel army during the Libyan Revolution, documenting his experiences in the war while fighting in it. During the war, he was captured and held as a prisoner of war for nearly 6 months in two of Libya's most notorious prisons before escaping from prison and returning to combat on the front lines. After the war in Libya, he went to Syria, where he shot and directed the award-winning short film Not Anymore, A Story of Revolution. Thank you both for joining us here.
Thank you. Can
Me
I just
too.
Give our URL one more time? It's
yeah.
pointandshootfilm.com, and there's a great Facebook page as well.
Excellent.
Point and Shoot.
This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can scroll down on the right-hand side to subscribe to iTunes podcasts. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now. Took the kids to the park and disappeared by half.